This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. So a lot going on, right? We've got advisors to the US FDA. They're meeting to talk about whether to recommend Pfizer-BioNTech's shot for children as young as five. This is something I know you've been watching really closely.
It is. And at the same time, we're also seeing hospital admissions declining sharply among US children who have COVID-19, even more so than adults.
Such
that quiets
news.
Concerns for now that the return to school could trigger a major uptick in viral transmission. I have to say, I'm optimistic about where we are right now.
I am too, but aren't you feeling like a little bit, as it gets a little bit colder and we're inside more, I'm just like
yeah,
waiting
but
to
it's,
see.
Yeah, but it's mid-October already.
Feeling good.
Feeling good.
All right. Fingers crossed. Let's see what our next guest has to say as we do our daily check on COVID and the pandemic. Dr. Darshak Sankhavi is a member of the C-suite at the digital healthcare platform Babylon, chief medical officer there. He was the director of preventive and population health at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. That was during the Obama administration. He is with us on the phone in Boston. Dr. Sankhavi, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you?
Great to talk to you both.
Well, it's great to have you here. First of all, we want to get into a little bit of what you guys are doing specifically at Babylon. But when you look at COVID and some of the headlines, how does it feel to you? Do you have the same optimism that Tim does, that even as it gets colder here in the East Coast, it feels like the numbers are settling and going in the right direction for the most part?
It does. We're certainly seeing that nationwide in the U.S. right now, that the numbers are going in the right direction. And I think that we're in a good place now, at least with vaccinations on the uptick. And particularly with the availability of the third vaccination for individuals at high risk. So I am optimistic. You know, the virus has a way of surprising us, so time will tell. But I'm feeling better about where we're at now.
Dr. Sankhavi, what's a realistic way for us to think about the moment that this becomes endemic and is no longer a pandemic?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say that you know, some epidemiologists are arguing we're already there right now, that it is endemic in the sense that, you know, we are not going to go towards eradication, but rather probably repeated cycles of, as we see with the influenza virus now. So I think that's sort of probably what most people are thinking. But again, hard to tell for sure.
All right. So talk to us about your platform at Babylon. What exactly are you doing? Because we talked to a lot of companies and heads of companies that have definitely moved into telehealth and telemedicine much more aggressively, certainly because of the pandemic and post-pandemic. Tell us a little bit about your approach there at Babylon.
Right. So at Babylon, we are a digital health platform. So we enable healthcare. And the thing that's really exciting about Babylon is we're not just about that one-time visit, but rather taking care of that full spectrum of care. And that's supported by broadly our model where we take what's called full risk. In other words, we're not just responsible for that one time somebody has a cough or a cold or wants something, you know, for a one-time illness, but really we're trying to help them throughout their entire course. So that's through chronic illness, through hospitalization afterwards, and our digital tools really sort of are that, take them through that entire journey. So we're trying to improve the value of healthcare end to end, and that's really what distinguishes us at Babylon.
We saw a huge uptick in the use of telemedicine throughout the pandemic, especially at the beginning of the pandemic. I'm wondering what numbers you're seeing. What can you tell us about the data that you see on the platform that indicates growth will continue and strength will continue when this does become endemic and people are comfortable going back to the doctor's office?
Yeah, so we've seen, for example, just in the first half of 2021, this year during the pandemic, we've delivered about 1.6 million clinical consultations and had about 1.8 million AI interactions. So that's really sort of gives a sense of the regulatory and financial barriers that really were in the way before with telehealth, as they've been taken away and we've taken on a number of ways of making this more accessible. I think people really feel that this is extremely convenient and our hope and the data we're seeing is that really will continue over time. It's just a new way of getting your care. It's much more around your schedule, not around your doctors or the healthcare systems.
Well, and so how's the infrastructure, the establishment in terms of, you know, it's interesting, healthcare programs and plans certainly opened up because of the CARES Act when it came to telemedicine during the pandemic. And we definitely have seen, I think the HHS announced the renewal of the public health emergency, the COVID-19 PHE, for another 90 days. So that's through about mid-January of 2022. But do you anticipate that these alternative ways, these digital ways of getting healthcare, are with us forever, and that we'll get approval from regulators that they will be all in, so that healthcare providers are also covering all of this?
Yes. So I do believe that digital health is here to stay. Once you've sort of uncorked that demand and people see how convenient it is, we're certainly seeing persistence around that. Now, the challenge is we get the regulatory flexibility and the payment flexibility to do it in a way that our patients have come to enjoy and expect. Our hope is that that will, in fact, occur. Even if that doesn't, that's the benefit of having full risk, because at Babylon, we're responsible for the full spectrum of care. So we can actually, in the U.S., then pay for the things and build the system we need without actually waiting for the regulators to catch up necessarily in all those areas.
All right. We're going to leave it on that note. Hey, listen, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Dr. Darshak Singhravi, he is Chief Medical Officer at Babylon, on the phone from Boston. We should point out that today, interesting time for them, because Babylon completed its business combination with a SPAC and trading today. It's under the ticker BBLN. And in fact, that SPAC is up 15.6% in today's trading session.
And just a little plug for our show tomorrow. The CEO of the company, Babylon, will be on Quick Take Stock at noon Eastern Time tomorrow.
Oh, good. So you'll have to continue that conversation, right? That's cool stuff.
This is The Big Take, the best of Bloomberg's in-depth original reporting from around the globe.
We're running on a financial system that's running on old technology.
We're seeing house prices reach fresh record highs.
What unfolds in midterms, we will no doubt see again in the next presidential election.
The Big Take on Bloomberg Radio.
It's today's Big Take. Its focus is the world's top business cities, and they are still failing working women. The story is by Ruth David and Adam Blenford. You can check it out at Bloomberg.com and by typing in NI Big Take on the Bloomberg terminal. Rebecca Penty is Solutions and Strategy Editor at Bloomberg Business Week. She joins us on the phone from London. Rebecca, safety, mobility, maternity, equality, and wealth. These are the five categories that Bloomberg went through in order to assess these cities. Toronto, number one. How did it get to the number one spot?
Well, you're speaking to someone who's from the Toronto area, but I can assure you that did not influence the outcome. I'll take you back to how this originally started. I'm here based in London, and back in March, a story exploded here in the city, and it remains a massive story. That was the death of Sarah Everard. She was a 33-year-old marketing executive who was walking home through a London park, and she was abducted, raped, and murdered by a London police officer. This just shook the city to its core, and you know, a refrain on social media was, she was just walking home. So Bloomberg reporters, in the wake of that killing, thought, let's take a look at how safe these major business hubs are for working women. This was a young working woman who was walking home. And we commissioned a bespoke survey, surveyed 200 women in each of the 15 cities that we looked at. We sifted through publicly available data on crime, on wealth, on equality. We decided to expand this beyond just safety and look at how are working cities enabling women or not enabling women to succeed. And what we came out with is Toronto at the top of the list. We can get into that a little bit later. But what I will say is that what we found, the big takeaway, is that inequality is rife everywhere. Toronto was 3.66 out of a possible 5, and that was the best.
Well, this is what...
In Sao Paulo, right at the bottom.
Rebecca, I'm just going to say, looking through the numbers, and, you know, as you said, a scale of 1 to 5, and there's just a few fours or just over 4. But basically, even though Toronto is the top, the point is there's really no city that, if you look at those four metrics, those key five areas, that nobody's really doing well, especially on all fronts.
Yeah. And some of it was quite surprising to me. But But once we sifted through the data and did our interviews with women in each place, we also featured voices, you know, testimonies from working women in each city. We started to piece together where cities were lacking. So in Asia, for example, the Asian cities, Tokyo, Seoul, Hong Kong, did very well on safety. But yet in Japan, for example, only 13% of managerial jobs are held by women. That's insane to me.
You really want to use a different word, don't you? It's crazy, right?
And what we found is that they don't have the maternity provisions in place. Men are not encouraged to take parental leave, so the burden falls on women.
Right.
In Germany, where they do have the maternity provisions, we found that there is a lack of childcare options. So women end up staying home anyway and don't go back into the workplace. And there you have major shortage of women in senior roles in business and in politics, despite the fact that the country's been run by a female, Angela Merkel for
years. We've got to run, unfortunately, but I highly recommend, and Tim and I will put it out on Twitter because there's so much information there. Rebecca Penty, thank you. Solutions and Strategy Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Right now, though, we do want to get to and highlight a story from Businessweek. You haven't heard of her, at least maybe not yet. And yet she is President Biden's pick to be the U.S. banking watchdog if politics allows. Here with that story is Bloomberg Businessweek Editor Joel Weber. He is in our Interactive Brokers studio. Robert Schmidt wrote the story. He's our finance reporter at Bloomberg News. Joel, this is when you guys always step up to the challenge and you bring us somebody that we need to know about, have on our radar. And she's a little bit controversial, a lot controversial, actually.
That's right. And we're talking about Cornell Law Professor Saul Omarova, who is really, really turned into this has been at the center of this political hot potato fight in D.C. And would you ever expect anything else? But sometimes... You just find someone who really lights up the room, and that's clearly what's happening with this nomination.
The Comptroller of the Currency. It's a branch of the Treasury.
Oh, yeah, it sounds is that boring. But it's not.
It sounds so boring until you hear Republicans call her a Marxist, and then you're like, wait, what?
And they're looking at her college thesis. They're looking into where she was born.
It's literally, so she is a graduate of Moscow State University. Came up through Kazakhstan, was born in Kazakhstan when it was part of the former Soviet Union, came to the U.S. in 1991. So all of that, where you've come from and where you studied, has just become fodder for Republicans. And because of the razor-thin margin, we don't know how this one's going to play out yet. But it just embodies this, lack of bipartisan spirit. It does have this, it's got a wonky title, but it is an important role that Wall Street really cares about.
Well, that's what I had to remember. Like, okay, what does this individual do? And especially at a time where the financial sector is going through, a lot of disruptive changes, right? Whether it's fintech, whether it's cryptocurrencies. She would have a lot of oversight of that.
Yeah, it's besides regulating the national banks, it's all these, these burgeoning areas of finance that right now have sort of little oversight of government. And so in theory, this nomination, you could be stepping into a really important role. She's no fan of Wall Street. It's interesting because
there's a certain word she uses to describe them, and you're going to have to read the story to find out.
Because you can't say it on the radio.
Well, we could, but we might be removed quickly.
I'm not saying it.
Bleep. So she's basically, not loved by certain quarters, loved by the progressive wings of the Democrat Party. Who obviously have turned this in. They say that all of this is red baiting, and it harkens back to the old McCarthy era. So it just brings out everybody's best in D.C. It's like best feet forward for these nominations sometimes.
Well, let's bring in Robert Schmidt, finance reporter for Bloomberg News. He's with us from the Bloomberg 99.1 studio in Washington.
He wrote the story.
Robert, bring us up to speed on what parts of her background specifically Republicans are latching onto, and how, in some cases, that's actually increasing support, as you write, among Democrats.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me. And as you know, the Senate is 50-50, and this is a confirmed position. So she really, it'll be tough to get her confirmed if there's one Democrat that doesn't support her. And, you know, this thing has devolved. What was interesting to us is this is kind of an obscure professor. It's an obscure agency that a lot of Americans haven't heard of, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. And it quickly devolved from stuff we're used to seeing, which is our debates about policy, and into something about her background. And she was born in Kazakhstan in the former Soviet Union. Went to Moscow State University, and as the Republicans have been pointing out, was on a Lenin scholarship. So there's kind of they're definitely suggesting that maybe she's still a communist supporter.
She's denied that, obviously, but she was also a lawyer for big banks. That's
yeah,
an
she
important
certainly
part of
was.
Her resume.
Yeah, and she worked in the Treasury Department during the Bush administration.
So, Robert, what do we think if she were to get nominated? What would be the her sort of top priorities? Do we think?
Well, the people I talk to that know her say that she really focuses on the consumers of banks rather than the banks themselves, and that would be a big change from the OCC, which is generally it's an important agency and it regulates over 1,100 banks. But it's also a place where banks feel very comfortable talking to the heads and with the regulation. And so they think it would be kind of a sea change in that area.
But how fearful is the traditional bank, big bank industry? I mentioned a documentary. We're not going to mention the name, but everybody should definitely go read your story so that they can see it to see how she feels about kind of some of those who run the big banks. But she did say in this documentary, she spoke of the law as a way to reduce the economic rewards for self-serving behavior. And so she is looking at the industry and the people behind it. I mean, is it safe to say that the big bank and the CEOs who run those big banks, they don't like her?
Yeah, they're definitely concerned about it. And they say, well, oh, we're not interested about her background. What we're interested in is her scholarship. And she has had some ideas that are novel and some would say radical. One would be making the Federal Reserve an actual bank where people could open checkings and savings accounts, and it would take a lot of business away from the banking industry.
We have to leave it there. Go watch that documentary. Just check out the story. I don't know. It made me chuckle when I read it. Robert Schmidt, thank you, thank you. Finance reporter at Bloomberg News. Joel, that's going to be in the upcoming issue?
It is. Finance section. Mm-hmm. And many more, including, you know, something we'll talk about tomorrow.
Ooh,
that'll be a big take.
Deep tease. Joel Weber, nicely done. Editor at Bloomberg Business Week. You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week right here on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, you are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Among our most read stories on the Bloomberg, actually, Tim, is it still our most read story on the Bloomberg? Pulling it up, and it's among our most read. It's one that looks at the Democrats' latest tax proposal and their target, U.S. billionaires that lay claim to some $5 trillion ka-ching in wealth.
The story by Ben Steverman, Sophie Alexander, and Scott Carpenter. Ben Steverman joins us now. He's personal finance editor at Bloomberg News. He's with us from New York City. Ben, explain exactly what Democrats want to do, because they're targeting about 800 U.S. billionaires who have about $5 trillion.
Hashtag
in
really, really
wealth.
Rich.
Yeah, the ultra rich in this country.
Yeah, so one thing that's been frustrating Democrats and progressives for a while now, and you saw it come out in the proposals by people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders for a wealth tax, is that billionaires don't really pay taxes that are really commensurate with their wealth. So a lot of the wealth that goes to billionaires, as you know, is in the form of unrealized capital gains. So it's the stock goes up and up and up of like an Amazon for Jeff Bezos or a Tesla for Elon Musk. And all that is not taxable income. It's only taxable. Investments are only taxable when they're sold. And so what Democrats would like to do is unlock some revenue from these sort of a broader definition of income. And what they're trying to do is focus this new, it would basically be an entirely new tax system, focused on billionaires. I think the criteria they're talking about now is people that have $1 billion or more, or who make more than $100 million in 3 years. And if you make more than $100 million in 3 years in a row, you're probably on your way to being a billionaire. So the idea is, we haven't seen the full details, but the idea is that folks would have to pay a tax every year on any publicly traded assets, and then on any privately paid traded assets, you would have to pay extra when you sold them to reflect the fact that you weren't paying along the way.
So every year, if you have a little kitty or big kitty of a bunch of investments, let's say in the market or what have you, or private equity or whatever, a hedge fund, you'd have to pay a tax on that.
Yeah, you have to pay a tax on the gain. Or if you had a loss, you would get a deduction for that loss.
So help me out here, because Tim and I talked earlier about this investment conference that's going on over in Saudi Arabia. And Larry Fink of BlackRock said, I think when we talk about taxes, we just always talk about the federal level. He basically said he pays a tax rate of about 55% because he's based in New York City. Is he right?
In a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, he probably is right that he's paying by a certain definition of his income, right? But Larry Fink is also has, I think, huge holdings in BlackRock. And he's probably not selling those, and he's probably not counting the increase in the value of BlackRock shares over time in his income. So, and that's the thing that Democrats are trying to get at here. They're really trying to shift the debate and have a broader definition of income, one that is controversial, especially among certain billionaires, but maybe is more reflective, you could argue, of their actual true economic income, their true economic power in our economy and in our society.
Ben, we have to talk politics here because a plan is just that right now, a plan.
Yeah.
And I have to think about two senators in particular who have helped whittle away President Biden's ambitions, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia. What do moderate Democrats think of a plan like this?
I think we're going to have to find out over in the next few days as they absorb this idea, which is a new idea for a lot of people who aren't tax experts. I think, you know, we're kind of at this weird stage of these tax debate where maybe this is a sign we're getting closer to the end, where everyone has sort of having to consider their second or third or fourth favorite ideas for raising revenue. There are a lot of possibilities out there for how Democrats can raise revenue. But Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona has said that she does not want to reverse the rate cuts that were put in place under Donald Trump. So no rate cut for corporation, no hiking the rates for corporations or wealthy people or capital gains, which is all things that Biden had proposed and that even Joe Manchin from West Virginia seemed to be open to.
What's
doing that is very simple, but doing this is a much more complicated option.
Yeah. What's really cool in your stories is you get to some of the big billionaires that would be impacted, whether it's Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, you say would be hugely affected by the proposal, Mark Zuckerberg, too, because their fortune is almost entirely in the companies that they created, right? So that they, from the get-go, if this passed in day one or year one of the tax, they would be required to pay taxes on any built-in gain on their tradable assets up until now. So that could be massive, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could be, you know, the top rate on capital gains right now is 23.8. So you'd have basically a fifth to a quarter of these guys' stakes in, you know, these are $150, $200 billion stakes in these companies,
right,
potentially that they would have to pay in taxes. Now, apparently the law will make a provision that they can pay that over 5 years, wouldn't have to go all at once. You know, advocates of this say, oh, well, these folks can borrow, which is something that some of them already do. They can borrow against the shares to pay the tax. Wealthy people have way more resources and ability to pay than others do, but still, this could really change almost the ownership of these corporations that are some of the leading tech companies in the country.
Hey Ben, very briefly, because my head is spinning, just in the last 15 seconds, does that mean that they would get taxed every year on the same assets, or would it be a one-time thing?
No, what you would get after the first year, you would pay on the built-in
okay.
gains that you've had up until now, and then for every year afterward, you would pay taxes or get a deduction on your gain or loss
okay.
from
in
that
point
year,
great.
In that calendar year.
But Larry
yeah.
Ellison owns a Hawaiian island or most of it, and then a lot of the housing stock and a grocery store. How do you value that, Tim?
Business school students, work on it.
All right, accountants, get ready. Ben Steverman, you are our tax expert. He's also personal finance editor here at Bloomberg News on the phone in New York. A lot going on this Tuesday, and that includes the U.S. FCC, Federal Communications Commission, voting to revoke licenses held by China Telecom and pledging more steps to purge the U.S. market of Chinese tech companies in the name of security. It was a red headline when it crossed the Bloomberg terminal earlier today. Here with what you need to know, Bloomberg News is Todd Shield. He covers technology in the FCC. He's with us on the phone from Maryland. Todd, walk us through exactly what the FCC did today and the significance of it.
This is an interesting move. It's been brewing for a number of months or years at the FCC as it examines the role of Chinese telecommunications carriers in the U.S. market. These carriers do not have a big share in the U.S. market, but they do have links to Chinese networks, and that's the source of concern by U.S. security agencies and increasingly now the Federal Communications Commission. So today it said that China Telecom Americas, a subsidiary of Big China Telecom based in Beijing, the FCC said China Telecom Americas poses a threat of espionage due to its control by a state-owned company and thus its control by the Chinese government, says the FCC. The company says, no, it's not controlled by the Chinese government. But there it sits. The FCC, on a 4-0 vote, would purge the U.S. of this company within 60 days. They've got to shut down within 60 days unless something happens.
Todd, you write that since 2019, the FCC has moved against telecom equipment maker Huawei Technologies, barred China yeah. Mobile from the U.S. market, moved toward ending authorizations for China Unicom America, Pacific Networks Corp, more. Is there any difference between the policy enacted under the Trump administration from the FCC versus what's happening under the Biden administration?
Yeah, this is interesting. And here was a question we all had over the months as we changed administrations. But it appears not, at least in regard to telecommunications. There's the same sort of emphasis, the same rhetoric, and the same steps are being taken, with perhaps more to come. One of the FCC commissioners is proposing similar steps against a big drone maker, DJI. So
wow.
On it goes, and not a real change in rhetoric or action.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, this is the backdrop of, you know, beginning certainly during the Trump administration, continuing even into the Biden administration, fair to say, in terms of the growing tensions between the United States and China. Is it the result of that, or is that the catalyst, or is it true oversight and really having some serious national security concerns?
You know, I always try to parse out the chicken and the egg here. I'm not really sure. I do know that intelligence agencies have for years now, at least since 2012, warned about the capabilities, the digital capabilities of Chinese companies in the U.S. market. And that's because the world has changed. When we were analog, a phone line was a phone line. Now your phone's a beacon and it broadcasts to the world where you are and potentially hoovers up data about everything, you know, people around you and devices around you. So it's a much different world now than it was 20 years ago. So how much of it is just the technology is so much more capable? How much of it is the tensions are just higher? Probably a mix of it all, to tell you the truth.
Mm. Todd, you really piqued my interest with the mention of the drone maker DJI. I was in Prospect Park over the weekend and saw somebody using a DJI drone. Well, I should say they were trying to. They couldn't quite figure out how to make it fly. And that's how I was able to see it was a DJI drone. What do you think the regulators' concerns are with a company like that?
They're afraid that those drones can just go around and take pictures and collect Wi-Fi addresses, and who knows what you can do with a drone like that in terms of collecting, you know, soft intelligence like this. And every time I talk to an intelligence professional, they say, well, it's not so much a secret. You get patterns of movements. You figure out where people are, and I don't know. You know, you could fly one perhaps outside of a military base. You know when shift change is, so you know it gives you an inkling on what's going on, you know, things like that. So it's the power of data compounded and surveillance compounded. A zillion little instances add up to a form of pointillism that forms a detailed picture.
So what's,
I'm told, I've never done.
What's more to come? So what we should be as investors, you know, who might be watching this market and watching some of the Chinese companies. I mean, it's certainly the tone towards Chinese companies has definitely changed because of Evergrande and the Chinese, you know, clampdown on so many different industries. But what should we be watching out for when it comes to maybe more oversight of China tech?
Well, we're going to see, definitely don't be surprised if the FCC acts against China Unicom or Pacific Networks and ComNet. Ditto the drone matter we just spoke about. Today, the FCC chairwoman said that they're making it a little bumpier to get permission for submarine cables, which is more data transfer. Interestingly, big companies, Google, Facebook, et al., those kind of folks are laying big cables across ocean floors. And now it's going to be a little harder for them to get permits. They're going to undergo more scrutiny. So we're going to see more. Anytime you're moving data, there's going to be question marks. So that's kind of the broad point coming out of all this.
Does this have ramifications with how Chinese regulators treat American companies trying to do business?
That's hard to tell, isn't it? So far, we haven't seen many repercussions that I know of in China, but China watchers may contradict me on that. And U.S. telecom operators, I don't think, move big into the Chinese market, so I don't think there would be a tit-for-tat to be had here. But, you know, there may be other retaliatory steps possible, but I'm just not sure on that.
All right, Todd, going to leave it there. Thank you so much. You really laid it out so well. Bloomberg News' Todd Shield, he covers technology and the FCC, joining us on the phone in Maryland. But it's, you know, greater oversight, right, of foreign companies, particularly some that we are kind of frenemies with.
I'm still thinking about those drones. That's a big deal.
I don't like it. We were out on the water this summer and had a drone. Somebody was playing with a drone. It was and we were like, it just freaked us out.
Feels
like
a little
it.
Weird to be standing somewhere and a drone just comes over. You have no idea where it comes from.
Feels invasive.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's happened to me.
Yeah, right? Not so cool. What is cool, though, is Dave Wilson and his chart of the day. And he's coming your way in just a moment right here on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we've got just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Tim and I are setting up our Bloomberg screens to get ready for the...
I'm stretching.
For the earnings dump.
Making sure I'm hydrated.
Exactly. Stretching the muscles,
yeah.
Standing for a little bit. Michael Sheldon is with us to count us down to the closing bell as we watch today's trade. We're definitely off our best levels of the session. Michael, by the way, Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group. He's back with us on the phone from Westport, Connecticut. Do you get as excited as we do about earnings?
Oh, every quarter, of course.
Was that sarcasm? I'm trying to feel that out.
No, absolutely not.
Well, so earnings so far, how does it feel?
So far, we're off to a pretty good start. Heading into this week, about 20% of the S&P 500 had reported their numbers so far. And the numbers, once again, are pretty positive. Heading into this quarter, for reference, earnings estimates were that growth would be about, corporate profits would rise about 27-28% on a year-over-year basis. And as we stand, again, as of last Friday, that number was up to about 32.7%. And another way to look at it is how many companies are beating estimates and by what amount. So the average company, as of last Friday, was beating estimates by about a little over 13%. And for reference, that compares with an average beat of about 8% going back over the last 5 years. So I think, importantly, the trend of companies beating earnings and analysts raising estimates, which started probably in the summer of 2020, at least for now, continues to be in force.
Are companies guiding conservatively and analysts are following that, or are things just better than analysts thought they would be in the last few quarters?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at this transcripts over the past few quarters, there are a number of things that come out. One is companies are talking about higher costs. Companies are talking about supply chain issues. So a number of these factors have been basically talked about for a few quarters now. And I think in terms of profits, corporate profits are important because stocks tend to follow the direction of corporate profits over time. So for all of 2021, we're looking at an increase of about 44% or so. But then that slows down to a growth of about 9% in 2021, 2022. So we're still likely to see growth next year, but that growth is likely to be more moderate than we saw this year.
Well, and it is interesting, too, and I wonder when it comes to the supply chain issues, you know, what do we need to be thinking about it as investors? Is it something that I think about our audience? Do we just be like, yeah, okay, it's how a company makes things, but we take for granted, right? We go to a store and we just take, you know, pick up a product and just assume it will always be there. But are we learning, and maybe do we need to, as investors, really understand the global supply chains that are out there? Just like during COVID, we got to learn what it is to create a vaccine and the steps that it has to take in order to be available to the public.
Yeah, that's a real good point. And we've found out a few things over the past several quarters. For example, that 40% of all our freight comes from the ports in Los Angeles and Long Beach. So maybe individuals are starting to think about other ways that we can bring that freight into the United States. Another example was during COVID, we found out that, believe it or not, a majority of the drugs that are actually consumed in the U.S. come from China. So there are certain things mm-hmm. which, as a result of events over the past few quarters, I think longer term that's actually bullish for the U.S. manufacturing sector, and we could have an onshoring or companies returning some business back to the U.S. It's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to be easy for some companies that have global supply chains, but on the margin, I think that's could provide a positive boost for U.S. manufacturing down the road.
Michael, it's interesting. Earlier today, we hit intraday records on the Dow and the S&P 500. And if you think where we were 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, what we were talking about, we were talking about supply chain challenges, we were talking about growth concerns, we were talking about inflation. What has really shifted? Because we've seen the market, the S&P 500, higher to the tune of about 6% just in a few weeks.
Well, there are a couple of things. One is everybody was talking about having a 5% pullback in the markets. And up until late October, we hadn't had a 5% pullback in one of the longest periods on record. And that dates back to, I think it was October of 2020. So over the past few weeks, we had about a 5.2% pullback in the S&P. And just like clockwork, investors have been buying the dips over the past few quarters, and investors came in. And I think another thing is at work, which is that third quarter GDP, the economy kind of downshifted a little bit during the third quarter. And we're going to get third quarter GDP that comes out this coming Thursday in a couple of days. And it's not going to be such a great number compared to what we've seen recently. But I think that's also looking in the rearview mirror.
Right.
If you look at today's consumer confidence data, for example, that was supposed to be down, but it actually was up. And one of the things that caught my eye, for example, is the conference board looked every month when they interview people, they ask, are you more likely, are jobs easier to get or are jobs harder to get? And they take the net of that, and what it shows is that the highest percentage of people found that jobs were easy to get going back to 2000. So if you look at that, along with, for example, some of the weekly claims data, which has been trending lower, I think the outlook for continued job growth is positive, and I think we'll start to see a pickup in economic data, which is why investors have been buying the dips, I think.
Well, we all kind of make a joke of it, but it's really fascinating. Even LinkedIn just, you know, sending tons of emails about the jobs that are available, you know, and they do it based on your profile, but it's a lot every day and pretty aggressive. Hey, is there anything that we could get from the big batch of earnings that we're going to get in just a few minutes time that could make you more interested or less interested in a Google, a Twitter, an AMD, a Visa, or a Microsoft?
Well, we actually own some of those names already in our portfolios and have owned them for some time. I think taking a step back, we're portfolio managers, but we're also investment advisors, and you want to have some growth, some tech in your portfolios and technology, because that represents the growth that you need to meet your investment returns. But I think the other thing is that whereas technology was really the main game in town over the past several years, maybe a decade or so, given the broadening of the economic landscape that we see next year, I think you want to have more broad exposure to the markets, a little more of a barbell maybe between growth and value, just a little more broad-based exposure going forward.
All right, good to know, and always good to get some time with you. Michael, be well. Nice to check in with you. Michael Sheldon, he's Executive Director, Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group, joining us on the phone from Westport, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.